you. The notion that hashtag Me Too was some sort of big breakthrough in the women's path to liberation is total hogwash. It's been clear to me for a long time that it's simply the latest salvo in a long crusade by feminists to crush male sexuality. It's been a really long campaign. I was fascinated to discover that the 19th century suffragettes had a slogan, "Votes for women, chastity for men." And that was all about bringing an end to women's sexual subjugation to men, which meant reining in male lust and keeping all men on a very tight leash. If they could see us now, the suffragettes would be celebrating in the streets. They've succeeded beyond their wildest dreams. Men today are not just chaste, they've been neutered. Leaving sex to the feminists is like letting your dog vacation at the taxidermist, said Camille Paglia. And that's right, men are now totally stuffed. And the feminists have achieved this through the politics of guilt and shaming, very public shaming. Fear of that shaming pulls all men into line for fear that they too will end up with a target on their heads. That's the reason we have men in power selling out other men. Malcolm Turnbull's up there imposing bonking rules on cabinet. Newspaper editors destroying men's lives, publishing unproven Me Too allegations. You don't have to look hard to track these. Guys, you can come and sit down the front, this room here. You don't have to look hard to find evidence of these successive waves of feminism attacking male sexuality. In the second wave feminists in the 1970s, Kate Millett's book, Sexual Politics, which was known as the Bible of Women's Liberation, denounced raunchy male novelists like Henry Miller and Norman Mailer, slamming their depictions of sex as all about misogynist subordination of women. We then saw wave after wave of denouncing men for their sexual habits. Men were endlessly in trouble over sex, in trouble for not keeping their trousers zipped, for groping and harassing women, for looking at pornography or gazing at women in the wrong way. A few years ago, there was this fascinating book called The Testosterone Files, written by a young feminist writer who has a sex change, becomes a male, and I might just hang on. So she becomes a male and she's sort of blown away by the urgency of her desires, his desires, you know, looking at the covers of girly magazines and the newsagents. But what was fascinating, he said he watched the female audiences in talk shows wagging their fingers at sheepish male guests who are publicly shamed for being porn addicts or womanizers. And he's shocked by women's ready assumption of moral superiority. Do you remember that Macquarie Street banker a while ago? You know, there's some sort of spokesperson for the bank is doing a report on finance, and he was caught in the background looking at a computer which had a sort of half-naked celebrity on the cover. And he was shamed around the world for enjoying looking at a woman's body. Or there was another old guy sitting next to Princess Mary at some official function, and she's got major cleavage, and he's caught having a good look. She sees him looking and quickly adjusts her cleavage and gives him a very disapproving look. And he too was caught on video and shown everywhere and denounced as a dirty old man. Now just think about that. Like all women, she has the right to dress how she likes, to flaunt her sexual power over men, but woe betide any male who's caught looking, particularly if he's old or ugly or not in her target market. And that's what's happening everywhere. We've got this tiny group of feminist extremists who've convinced us this is a totally reasonable way for women to behave. I recently took part in an SBS documentary, which is based around a survey which found 19% of Australians call themselves feminists. And, of course, that's absolutely being swollen by the large number of young women graduating from humanities courses in our universities, which are totally captured by ideology. 65% of men and women feel sexism has gone too far. We've still got some seats down here, people. So So we've essentially got this tiny group controlling our society. Look what happened when the women started flooding into traditional male workplaces. Encouraged by the feminist movement, they started imposing new rules about male behaviour. You know, even in car factories or army barracks, you weren't allowed to put up sexy calendars anymore. They started imposing rules about sexy jokes or banter, even though there are plenty of women who enjoy that sort of talk. I mean, that's been the amazing thing for me. This tiny group, deviant group of women is deciding how men and women should behave everywhere. And, of course, post-Me Too, we've got men's lives being ruined, men even killing themselves, because 20 years ago they propositioned a woman in the workplace, even though the workplace is the place where most people, a lot of people, actually start new relationships. But you can now, of course, be hung, drawn and quartered for making a proposition, even asking someone out, which is deemed as inappropriate in a workplace. So we've got this constant demonising, constant defining male sexuality as deviant. And I think the real point is that most sensible men and women enjoy the erotic spark. It's one of the things we like about being in a workplace where there are men and women working alongside each other, is banter, flirtations, male and female interaction. But we've all been silenced into expressing our views about this sort of issue. You remember when Chris, the West Indies cricketer, Chris Gayle, jokingly asked out of a television reporter who was interviewing him. And I think most people thought the outrage that in response to that was just ludicrous. There were all these examples emerged of female sports people, you know, coming on to commentators, coming on to other people on television, and they never got into trouble. I mean, it was just incredible. And the poor guy was fined $10,000 by his cricket club because sports administrators were busily virtue signalling their way out of trouble. Or more recently, there was AFL managers who were forced to resign when it was discovered they were having affairs, which had nothing whatsoever to do with their job. So all the kowtowing by men in power is driven by the politics of guilt and shame. And what worries me is there's growing numbers of women who are going off sex in long-term relationships, and they are very much part of this protest, if you like, against male sexuality, because there are a lot of women who just aren't interested in sex, and they're easily constricted by the feminists to do their work for them. I've been growing alarm about the numbers of women who are going off sex in long-term relationships. I've been following this for many years. A few years ago I did a book about it. And you find that across the Western world, the gap between men and women in terms of sexual desire is increasing. Huge numbers of heterosexual married men are living lives of sexual deprivation, having sex doled out to them occasionally, like meaty bites to a dog, as one man said, or having sex not at all. My favourite was the man who said he got so sick of initiating sex that he finally said to his wife, "That's it, next time we have sex, you're going to initiate." That was 8 years ago, and they haven't had sex since. So what's interesting to me is you've got this big group of women who aren't very interested in sex, and they're easily constricted by the feminists to come on board various campaigns they're running against male sexuality. And so even if you talk about the fact that that there is some sort of sexual obligation in the marriage, that it's just not reasonable for men to live their lives dealing with constant sexual rejection, you get howled down. If you Google my name, you'll find one of the favourite slogans for me is that I'm a rape cheerleader. And that's all over the Twitter sphere. And I was once speaking at the ANU about all of this, and they, of course, had protests outside the university saying it was violence against women to suggest there was any obligation to even talk about looking after each other's sexual needs. So we have lots and lots of women living happily celibate lives, and men are having to just cop it sweet. So amazingly to me, we're having a across the world, a move to criminalize customers of prostitutes. They've got laws now in place in many European countries, Canada, and so on. A man having an affair knows that could mean the end of their marriage and the loss of their families. And what we particularly see now is endless talk about porn addiction, that men are liable to become sex addicts if they look at too much pornography. Back in the 80s, there was this lunatic, a real fruit loop called Andrea Dworkin, ferocious anti-porn campaigner, trying to shut down the sex shops and video shops. She saw intercourse as consorting with the enemy, as Dachau brought into the bedroom and celebrated. So it started decades and decades ago, this real campaign against pornography, and that's just simply seems to be increasing every year. And yet we've had really good research actually in Australia showing that most men have seen pornography. Many use it regularly. There's no good evidence that it's turning them into addicts, that they have difficulty controlling their use. I did research into this a few years ago and found lots of men use it to keep a lid on their sexual frustrations, particularly when they're not getting much sex in their marriages. But any man who looks at porn knows that the risk is if they're caught using it, they'll be shamed. And, you know, it's seen as their, by their partners as some sort of betrayal, like having an affair. Just think about how differently we reacted when we had this crazy book, 50 Shades of Grey, which became the all-time best-selling book. All the commentators were out in force saying, oh, this is mummy's porn, how wonderfully liberating for women to be able to read about sexuality in this way. And of course, even though the book is full of S&M, you know, pretty tricky sort of stuff from a feminist point of view, that was fine because women know how to differentiate between fantasy and reality. But of course, daddy's porn is something totally different. Men don't know how to differentiate between fantasy and reality, and the real risk is that it's going to turn men off normal sex if they get involved with pornography. I mean, the big difference, of course, has always been men tend to like visual sexual material, and women are more interested in words and plots and so on. The famous South American writer Isabel Allende talks about the difference between erotica and pornography. Erotica is like using a feather, pornography, the whole chicken. men have always enjoyed the whole chicken. And there's always been chickens around. I mean, there's always been types of visual pornography, visual and sexual material that men have enjoyed. I once knew a man who used to say, decades ago, he said, he used to lie in wait for the Sunday paper to be delivered so he could leap on it and see whether there were any Kmart catalogues with women in underwear. But so the shaming continues, and the battle against pornography is only just part of that. But it's not just, of course, about sex. I talked the other on Friday about what's happening in our universities. The universities investigating, you know, the committees that have been set up investigating sexual assault on campuses, the fake rape crisis on our campuses, the sexual consent courses. But there are other issues that are just as important. I've been involved in the last few weeks in a campaign to help a young man in Perth who's a counsellor, who was a counsellor with Relationships Australia in West Australia. And he's just been pushed out of his job for posting an article I wrote and I published nearly 2 years ago in the Weekend Australian on domestic violence. What I'd done is I spent months and months pulling together all the research and all the recent statistics on domestic violence, which of course shows that at least a third of the victims of violence, domestic violence, are male. And there's over 40 years of research showing that most family violence is two-way violence involving violent women as well as men. And he put my article up on his private Facebook page and was involved in a bit of a discussion about that, saying that the other counsellors were saying they see violent women as well as violent men. And he was forced out of his job. We've started a crowdfunder to support him. So if you'd like to go on my website, you'll see that. Maybe some of you could contribute to this guy. He's taking the Relationships Australia to the Fair Work Commission over unfair dismissal. But so we'll see how that goes. But in the meantime, he's out of a job. So there are constant lies being told about a whole range of issues, including domestic violence, and everywhere people are being shamed out of not calling them out, these lies, for fear of being branded a misogynist who doesn't want to protect battered women. It's a really difficult issue to confront this publicly. So we have our Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, boasting of spending hundreds of millions of dollars on domestic violence and saying it's all about respect for women. Do you remember that? Yeah, I'm sure you've all seen that ghastly ad where the little boy, you know, slams the door in a girl's face and it's all about respect for women. That's a total lie. There is no good evidence that in Western countries like Australia that it's anything to do with misogynist attitudes to women. There's a whole range of research showing what domestic violence is all about, and that's the least important factor in our sort of country. David Leinhelm has been busily asking questions in Senate estimates, grilling the bureaucrats who started that who involved that TV campaign, say, where's the evidence for this? And of course, they can't come up with anything. Police in Brisbane a few months ago were required to take part in a White Ribbon Day. You know about White Ribbon? White Ribbon is this organisation which is conscripting men to stand up against violence for women, which is laudable in a way, except for this organisation absolutely refuses to acknowledge that any male's a victim of violence. And these police were being asked to make pledges, say, I stand up against violence against women. And some of them refused to do that because they say, we go into homes and we see violent women attacking their partners and their children. So they stood up and made a pledge saying, I support violence against everybody. And White Ribbon refused to use those pledges. We need to stand up against this. And it's really important we take people on. Okay. We need to take on the shamers and the guilt mongers. So any older women here? Oh, I always appeal to mothers of sons. We have to worry about the young generation of men. But any of you who have men in your lives you care about, you need to stand up and be counted because we are the majority. This group who's controlling our society is very much a minority group that could easily be shouted down if we were prepared to stand up against them. Thank you.